And anybody, any of you who have ran a, use Ngocensi's commentary as a guided meditation as we meditate. Let's see, I lost my spot. So just keep resting in awareness, following the breath. You could eat, well, yeah. Okay. So he says, first, it is important to start by arousing a deeply felt warmth, sensitivity, and compassion for all beings. So when he says for all beings, that is equanimity. Seeing everyone as the same. So whoever arises to us, we're sending, we're doing this meditation for all of them equally. And so he says this equanimity, within this equanimity, we arouse a deeply felt warmth, sensitivity, and compassion for all beings. So let's see if we can just generate that feeling. And whatever arises for you is fine. Last week, we first let our mind sort of expand, let our awareness expand to fill all of limitless empty space, and then within that we imagined that it was filled to capacity with sentient beings, and we generated love and compassion for all of them. So that's what we're doing here, same thing. And then he says, think about someone who has been very kind and loving to you. In most cases, this could be your own mother. It doesn't have to be your own mother, just someone that you have sort of an unequivocal, unconflicted feeling of benevolence toward and gratitude towards, who has helped you and been loving and kind to you. Remember and reflect on this person's kindness. Just anything, any reason you have to feel love and gratitude towards them. Just let that come to mind. When you feel strong love and compassion, like whatever that feels like for you, it may not be a specific feeling, but no worries there, however it feels, but just thinking of them with love and compassion. Imagine step by step that this person is undergoing the sufferings of the six realms. So this is similar to the meditation we did a couple of weeks ago. So we think of this person, whoever he or she is, or could be a pet, could be anyone that we just have undiluted feelings of love and compassion for. Imagine that person or that being in the hell realm. Repeatedly and brutally killed and revived, she is tossed into a boiling cauldron of molten bronze. She suffers in agony before your very eyes. So we just feel the distress and the compassion that that brings up for us. Then imagine that she has been reborn as a starving spirit, a hungry ghost, just skin and bones, and has not even so much as caught sight of food for 12 years. She stretches her hands out to you, imploring you, "My child, do you have anything you can give me to eat?" And again, whatever distress, that the thought of our loved ones suffering like that, we generate compassion, the wish for them not to. Imagine her reborn as an animal, a terrified doe being chased by hunters and their dogs. In panic, she leaps off a high cliff to escape them, but falls with unbearable pain, shattering all her bones. Still alive, but unable to move, she is finished off by the hunter's knives. So this is extreme because it helps us bring up what's called unbearable suffering, suffering that I mean, compassion that's so strong we feel we just can't stand it because we recognize that the suffering is so intense. And also because beings are suffering like this all the time, even when we're not aware of it. This kind of suffering exists. So we're just imagining our loved one undergoing it, and that makes it more vivid for us. Continue to imagine her undergoing in quick succession, situation after situation of suffering. An intense feeling of compassion will irresistibly well up in your mind. At that moment, when you have that feeling of compassion, turn that intense compassion to all beings, realizing that each one of them must surely have been your mother or your kind benefactor many times, and deserves the same love and compassion as your mother of this present life or your loved one of this present life. It is important to include all those whom you now consider enemies or troublemakers. So let's make an extra effort in this sort of effortless meditation to bring to mind someone we don't have kind feelings toward. Doesn't have to be someone you know personally, but we can all find someone. A political figure, a figure from history, someone from the past, and extend this feeling of unbearable compassion to them. We don't want even them to go through this kind of suffering. Reflect deeply about everything that all these beings are going through as they wander endlessly in samsara's vicious cycle of suffering. So now our attention is on all sentient beings because we've generated that feeling of compassion. And so now we're turning our attention to different situations that different people and animals and so forth are undergoing. Think about old, infirm people unable to care for themselves. Perhaps all of the residents of that nursing home in Florida that was without power and where people died. About all those who are sick and in pain. People who are desperate and impoverished, lacking even the most basic necessities. About people suffering famine and starvation, the pangs of hunger and thirst, those who are physically blind. There's so many places in the world where this kind of suffering is happening. Right now, Syria, Burma, parts of the United States. Intense suffering. And those are physical sufferings. Now we think about those who are spiritually destitute, who are starved of the nourishment of Dharma and blind to any vision, authentic vision of truth. Think about all those who suffer as slaves to their own minds, constantly maddened by desire and aggression, and about those who harm one another without respite, not knowing the consequences of it, not understanding the suffering they're causing. Visualize all of these different sentient beings as a crowd in front of you, and let all the different forms that their suffering takes arise vividly in your mind. I'm thinking of that Hieronymus Bosch painting a little bit. If we could only see all beings simultaneously. So we're seeing that in a way in our mind's eye right now, all the different kinds of unbearable suffering that so many beings are undergoing right now. All the insects that are being mowed down by my neighbor's lawnmower right now. All the worms that tried to make it across the burning pavement. All the baby birds that fell out of the nests. Each one of them is a life like our life and feels suffering as intensely as we would feel it ourselves. So that's the first step of taking and sending. And now within this intense feeling of compassion, Dingo Chenzi says, begin the practice of sending and receiving, or taking and sending. Start, he says, by focusing on your most hated enemy or someone who has caused much trouble and difficulty for you. You can't bring anyone to mind in your personal life. Again, most of us should be able to, but think of someone on a more global scale. Someone taking away healthcare, possibly. Not, that's not one person, but. So considering that person, think that as your breath goes out, all your happiness, all your vitality, merit, good fortune, health, and enjoyment is carried out to him on your breath in the form of cool, soothing, luminous nectar. So we do that as an actual visualization, visualizing this luminous nectar of light going out to this person who troubles us, who might be our enemy. And we think, make the following prayer. Make this truly go to my enemy and be entirely given to him, this nectar of light filled with happiness, vitality, merit, health, and so forth. Visualize that this person absorbs the white nectar of happiness, which provides him or her with everything they need. If this person's life was to be short, imagine that now it is prolonged. If they need money, imagine that now they are wealthy. If they are sick, that now they are cured. And if they are unhappy, now imagine them so full of joy that they feel like singing and dancing. All of this just to make this practice more vivid in our mind, which then brings up compassion in our heart. So that's as we breathe out. Let's do a few rounds breathing out this nectar of luminous happiness and vitality and health and so forth, good fortune, everything to this person that we don't normally have much use for. Breathing it out on each out breath. Now we'll turn to the in-breath. As you breathe in, consider that you take into yourself in the form of a dark mass, dark smoky light, all the sickness, obscurations, and mental poisons your enemy may have had, and that he or she is thereby completely relieved of all afflictions because you've breathed them in. Think that their sufferings come to you as easily as mountain mist wafted away by the wind. As you take this suffering into you, you feel great joy and bliss mingled with the experience of emptiness. Back to that dreamlike quality of our experience. It's not as solid and real as we might think. So luminous nectar of happiness on the out-breath, filling them completely. Dark, smoky, light filled with sickness, obscurations, mental afflictions, and so forth on the in-breath, taking it away from your enemy, and they are completely relieved of it. We'll do a few rounds like that. And now Dingo Chense says, do the same for the infinity of beings you are visualizing before you. So we haven't lost track of all sentient beings. We'll bring our focus back to them, filling all of limitless empty space. And send them all of your happiness and take in all of their suffering. Repeat this again and again until it becomes second nature to you. So we'll continue with all sentient beings as our focus for a few rounds. Taking away their suffering on the in-breath, sending them all of our happiness, health, and fortune, peace of mind on the out-breath. Taking in everything that's unwanted and feeling joyful about it. Sending everything that's wonderful and feeling joyful about it. Well, everyone to continue like that. I have to go check with my workmen for a minute. So just continue doing taking and sending for a minute or two, and I'll be right back. Continuing to breathe in the suffering of all beings in this Hieronymus Bosch-like universe. And breathing out happiness, good fortune, and health, and everything else that's good. All sentient beings, relieving whatever suffering they have. And if you're having any particular kind of suffering yourself, you can throw that right into the mix. Just breathe it right in with everybody else's. Let it dissolve. We usually add that part into our Buddha nature. And breathe out to all beings and to ourself, everything good. Relief from all of our problems. And now we will let go of the visualization. You can take your time with it. Letting go again of all conceptuality. And we're going to go right back now to resting in that non-conceptual essence, that awareness, that nature of mind that is our Buddha nature. And now we'll come back and do some other things. Continue with our studies. Well, okay, I have my doorbell ringing, so rest like that, or you can unmute yourselves and talk. I'll be back in a minute. On to do that. Share the screen so we can chant our verse, and I better check in with my battery. And through whatever's happening, we're just going to maintain contact with our Buddha nature, with the nature of mind, that vast awareness, many ways to express it. All right, share screen. I am now not seeing where I need to do it. All right, because I don't have the file open, that's why. I didn't open it in advance today, so we just have to wait a second for the file to come up. Okay, there it is. Let's see if we have them all. Oh yeah, I wanted to ask before we do the chanting, as far as verse 11, did everybody look at the blog, and does anybody have any input on which print translation they prefer? Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you. Marilyn?
I like the trade.
You like the trade, so did Anne. We now have two votes for each. The first one is, so the first one is to trade, because of this, to trade, I better look it up. Share a screen. It's the one that's there right now. Okay, because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for other suffering. And the other translation was to genuinely and fully exchange my happiness for other suffering. And I'll just explain why there are two. The first one, the meter works better. The second one, the meter's a little bit forced, but the sound, the actual sound of the word, exchange, works better here than trade. So I'm going to consider that still a work in progress. But do we, we'll just do it the way it is right now. We'll just do it the way it's on the sheet right now. And I will fully resolve that soon. And we'll talk, if anybody has a thought on that, please share it today. And I will make a decision after today. So today, in the interest of time, because we spent a lot of time on the meditation, which I meant to do, we'll just read the name of each verse until we get to the to verse 8. So practice one is to study, contemplate, and meditate. Practice two, to leave my homeland. Practice three, to rely on solitude. Practice four, to let go of attachment to this lifetime. Practice five, to give up negative friends. Practice six, to rely on spiritual friends. Practice seven, to seek refuge in the three jewels. Those are the preliminary practices for entering the path and practices that we need to keep practicing. Then the main teachings begin with verse 8, and we're going to chant 8 through 10 to remind ourselves of the three stages of the path, which brings us to the Mahayana, which is what allows us to do practice 11. Okay. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So I just want to say that that one is that first stage of the meditation we just did, of generating compassion. In verse 8, we're thinking about ourselves still, but vividly imagining or feeling our suffering is the first stage of entering the path, wanting to get away from this terrible suffering. So the next verse, like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So in this level of motivation, we not only want to escape from suffering, but we want to escape from samsaric happiness as well, because we recognize that that too is suffering and confusion. We want to be free of the whole thing that causes all the suffering. And then verse 10, my mother is each and every sentient being. Since time without beginning cared for me, how can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free. To cultivate the mind of full awakening, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this brings us fully into the bodhisattva frame of mind, the Mahayana path, like recognizing that we're not the only ones who are stuck in confusion and suffering. Everybody is. So we can't free ourselves and reach complete happiness if we don't bring everybody else with us. And now the verse we're doing today, we're really entering the practice now. Verse 10 was the beginning of the Mahayana path and aspiration bodhicitta, like wishing to bring all beings to happiness and to free them from suffering, to liberate them. And now we actually begin the practice of action bodhicitta, actually engaging in activity that will free beings from suffering. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So let's just chant that one more time. To exchange my happiness for others' suffering, this is how we do it. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's what we're going to do today and from now on. That is, as I said in the blog, this is the main tool. This is the primary tool in our bodhisattva toolbox. And we have to keep it nice and sharp. We have to sharpen it up and keep it sharp by doing taking and sending every day as part of our practice. So I have a meditation assignment on the blog in the blog post for verse 11, which is to meditate daily, like we're already doing that, because that fulfills verse 1, practice 1. If we're not meditating every day, then we're not on the bodhisattva path yet. We can't actualize it. So now, from now on, please include some taking and sending in your daily meditation, because that is the tool that we need for everything that follows and to actually practice bodhicitta in the world. The whole basis of that is this intention that we bring now to every interaction we have with anybody is, may they be happy, may I have their suffering, may they have my happiness. Imagine if we could do that. Imagine if everybody could do that. But imagine, just like, we can't expect everybody to have that attitude. It would be lovely. So we have to be the one who has that attitude, which means that somebody else is focused on their own happiness and they don't care about ours. They really don't care. They just want what they want. And so our aspiration and intention in that situation is to give them what they want and to take the bad stuff. Now, again, we always have to have this disclaimer. It doesn't mean we let people run over us or we let people hurt us or hurt other people. But when it's not like that, when it's not life and death, when it's just you want to be right, you want to have the last word, you want to win the argument, you want the last piece of pie, let the other person have it. As a bodhisattva, we always let the other person have it. We always let the other, and I don't do this myself. The pie I'm good with. You know, much as I like pie, I can give the other person the piece of pie. But the last word, that's a hard one for me sometimes. Like, I know I'm right. I know I'm right. But what does it matter? Like, what does it matter? And as I wrote on my blog like a couple of years ago, I really learned this well, even though I can't practice it well yet. I learned this really well dealing with my mother when she had dementia. She passed away 3 years ago now. But man, those last couple of years, and like, no matter what you did, she couldn't recognize it. Like, she could never really have gratitude. Okay, that's fine. But you can never reason with her. You can't win an argument with a person who has dementia, because they can only see what they see. It's just like trying to argue with a toddler, with a child. You know, if you try to reason with a two-year-old, like you try to get them to put on their clothes for a reason, they will always have a reason not to. Like, they can't recognize that your reason is better than their reason. It's not possible for them. So, you know, if they have to have their clothes on, so this is the exact example. They have to get dressed. They can't go out naked, even for their own protection. It's cold outside, whatever. They got to put the clothes on. So how can you give them what they want when they can't have what they want? Like, that's a lot of the time, that is, I think, the conundrum of the bodhisattva. Like, because we don't have the wisdom yet, we can't see clearly how to like benefit them in the situation where they have to do what they don't want to do. So what we do is we do it as kindly as possible, and we recognize when to be flexible, when they don't have to put their clothes on. Like, okay, they're just going to be home today. Maybe they don't have to put their clothes on until they get cold. And then they want to put their clothes on. So anyway, it's just something to ponder in our lives. Like, as we engage in every situation that arises before us, day after day, hour after hour, minute to minute, is like, how can I take this person's suffering and give them happiness? Like, where is it that I have that flexibility to make them happy at my own expense, if that's what it comes to, without letting them do something that would be actually harmful in some way? So does anybody have any comments? I mean, I think that's the gist of what we're grappling with in this verse, is we're gonna practice it on the cushion. Like, this is really important now. We have to practice this kind of exchange on the cushion, because we will forget, like life just overtakes us in every moment, and we'll forget if we don't develop the habit. So this is verse 2, leaving our homeland. This is how we leave our homeland, is we give up the old habit of my happiness, my last word, I'm right, I know I remember that correctly and you don't, you know, kind of thing. How do we do that? Oh, I think I just lost the thread. Sorry. How do we do that moment to moment? So anyway, that's what we're going to grapple with. In order to do that, we have to build up the habit. So that's leaving the homeland, right? Our homeland is, I want to be happy. And like, let the other person deal with it. And so now we are leaving our homeland by, like, I want the other person to be happy. Like, even if that's not how I feel inside, I am going to look at the situation and I'm going to impose my bodhisattva aspiration on it. How can I make this person be the one who leaves the situation happy? Hopefully it can be a way that we can both leave the situation happy. And if we're really on the bodhisattva path, we don't require a lot of ego stroking ourselves. But that is a work in progress. I can tell you for myself, that's a work in progress. So sometimes we just have to, you know, bite the bullet and be the one who's unhappy because we really wanted whatever it was. We want to win whatever it is we want. So we need to practice on the cushion. We need to practice when we're not in a situation to develop the reflex, the new homeland. It's the other shore. This is the other shore. Like where we think of the other person first, we are focused on other beings. And that's what this whole, all the commentaries on this verse are about. So I asked if anybody had anything to say and then I kept talking. Does anybody have anything that they would like to say at this point? Which is fine because we got plenty. John, did you have something?
I was just going to say, it seems like you wish for them to be happy is more of aspirational bodhicitta, and doing this tonglen, sending, receiving, taking on their suffering, seems like action bodhicitta.
Yeah, that's the way it's presented here. I think like, so you're in line, you're in tune with the way that it's being presented. And for me, it's a little more like, okay, to me, like taking and sending would almost feel more like aspiration or generating the intention, but here it's actually considered doing it. Like this is action bodhicitta. And I can see that, but that's not my natural first inclination here. So you got it exactly the way that that it's being presented, John. This is action bodhicitta now. It's the first step of action bodhicitta. And after this, if you've read my post, it's boot camp. Like we need this tool. So we're going to spend the next week practicing this. Please do some taking and sending every day and review the commentary every day if you can. Because next week, or I think next week we're still on this one because it's so important. We need this tool to be really well-defined. With verse 12, we're in boot camp for about 7 verses of like the worst things that can happen to us. What would a bodhisattva do? And it's not what we do generally. Maybe other people do. It's like not my go-to. It's not to react like a bodhisattva. So I'm learning that. That's why I need this text. This is why I need to say this. And that's what inspired me to want to teach this right now, is that I encountered the situation at the monastery. One of the exact, if not 2 or 3 of the exact situations described in the boot camp verses. And I did not react like a bodhisattva. You know, I mean, outwardly, I did what I had to do. But inwardly, I'm definitely a worldly person, like praise and blame. You know, no, don't blame me. So it's really like it's essential because you can be completely crushed by bad things happening and people treating you badly. And so this is how we prepare ourselves not to be crushed. Is to give it up, give up the ground before we're, you know, give up the ground at the beginning. Yeah, I'm unmuting you, Angela. You unmuted yourself, Angela, and I remuted you, and now you're good.
Okay. I think I'm in sort of a good situation or maybe example, so I thought I would share.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm teaching my 15-year-old son how to drive.
Ah.
Yeah. And so it's very scary for both of us, but if I don't make the world happy for him, if I make him nervous or upset, he's going to do that much worse, and it's going to keep battering back and forth. So I feel like it's like forced bodhicitta. Every time I get in the car, it's like, keep it right here. What do you want to be? Keeping it calm, not holding onto the door frame, not yelling. So yes. He's practiced doing that, but I really think it's kind of relevant to kind of exchange his happiness for mine, because he has to. We're in that vehicle together.
You're absorbing all of the discomfort of the situation as much as you can. You're just breathing it in so that he doesn't have to.
Right.
Yeah, same thing. I think that's a really excellent example. And I've been there. Anybody who's ever taught anybody to drive. Thank you for sharing that, Angela. That's great. And good luck.
Oh, thank you.
Sure, it'll all come out great.
Oh, he's doing well.
Right, you're in Tennessee. Do you have like some not too congested roads that you can?
Well, right now we're going on the congested ones because he's going to need practice through the whole thing. So yeah. He has to get 50 hours before he actually gets his lesson. So the whole point now is taking him on the interstate, taking him in the traffic times, getting him real practice so that when I'm not in the car, he can drive really great. So
let's all put ourselves in Angela's place for a moment. Like taking an untested teenage driver in the driver's seat onto the interstate, merging into the traffic on 95 in DC, say, and how that would feel, and how you have to keep breathing the happiness and the comfort and the relaxation to the person whose hands you're in, who like one wrong move and you know what can happen, but you can't control it, and you can't put the burden of the anxiety on the other person, because as Angela said, it will make it worse. Lovely example. Anybody else have anything? I am actually going to suggest something that I thought of this for myself like a couple of days ago. I've had like a lot of things happening that have been very uncomfortable for me lately, with the bathroom being torn out and all, so many things happening. Not just that, but some situations have arisen where like I really catch myself, you know, in the midst of like anxiety or reactivity, and I'm catching myself and going, what should I be doing here? Like, what would be like the best way to deal with this extreme stress that I'm dealing with and that I have no control over? And so I thought of, and I haven't done it yet because I haven't had time, of starting to have, at least temporarily while we're doing this, I first thought of calling it an adversity journal. But like a mind training journal, maybe we could call it the positive thing. And just for myself, writing down, like, what is the situation and what would a bodhisattva do? Like, and it's not always, like, it's not always the 37 practices that come to the rescue. Sometimes it's meditation instructions or whatever, like just rest in it. You know, just rest in the texture or the awareness of the thing that's happening and your discomfort with it. Rest in the middle of the anxiety or the anger or, you know, whatever it is. But sometimes it's the 37 practices. Exchange self for others. Remember everybody's been your mother. These things help. They really, really help. They don't make the situation go away. But our first impulse often is not to do that. Like, just it's the opportunity to see your reactivity, like right up close, your ego clinging and your reactivity and your me firstness. Or, you know, one thing that's really helped me through my stupid bathroom thing is like remembering like Hurricane Harvey and Irma, like just wiped out whole communities, whole parts of states. Like people have nothing in those places. They not only have no bathroom and no plumbing, but they have contaminated water everywhere and no facilities and no power. So that helps with the perspective too. But the Dharma also is a really good resource here. And that's what we're honing right now, is to always, we had a teacher last year at the monastery. I always have to remember his name. It's Lama Karma Somten from New Zealand. He's Tibetan Lama, but he's from New Zealand. Would anybody there for his teachings besides me? Lovely teacher. He's taught in English with a New Zealand, Tibetan / New Zealand accent. Like he kept saying, happy, right? Happiness, happy. He said it in some funny way that it sounded like something else, and now I can't remember what, but oh well. There were some really New Zealand moments, but what he was teaching was the 7 points of mind training, which is exactly what we're doing now in the 37 practices. And he said, you can boil mind training down to just a few words. It's like two words, others first. Like that's it. Others first. So every situation we go into now, it's like others first. How can I make this situation benefit the other person? And sometimes it is by intervening in what they're doing. But you're always not looking for your benefit. Like you're not looking for me first. And that is our reflex, me first. We can't help that. Even if it's subtle, it's me first. So we're now going to consciously try to enter every situation. Other first, others first. How does this benefit the other person? How can I give my happiness to this person and take this person's suffering? Or how can I take the unpleasantness on myself, as Angela was saying, and let the other person have the happiness and relaxation and feel good at the end? And maybe I don't feel good at the end. So we don't have a lot of time left. I'm taking this slow. We actually got a half hour almost. So what we're going to do is, let me just look at my outline. Yeah, we're just going to start with the Dingo Chensei. We're just going to look at Dingo Chensei today, and I don't know if we'll even finish because it's very rich. It's one of those very rich chapters. And then we'll look at Ken MacLeod next week. If you have Ken MacLeod, very good commentary on this verse in his book. But Dingo Chensei basically says it all. And in the other book, Geshe Jampa Tekchuk, which I haven't really gotten into yet, it's like 40 pages. So it's a very pivotal practice here. So verse 11, so on page 106. So on page 106, he makes it clear in the outline, and I want to point out one more time that the outline does not come from Dingo Chensei. He gave oral teachings, and we all have experienced what that's like with a Tibetan teacher. Like, there's no chapters and no headings, and, you know, it's just like you have this session and that session, and everything just sort of segues into the next thing. So this book was edited by the Padmakara Translation Committee, and they're the ones who will have added the textual outline, which I find very slightly different from how I would have probably done it, but it's a wonderful, wonderful resource and like 99% perfect. And then they continue the outline in the book. So here on page 106, we have the heading, the Bodhicitta of Application. And if we look back at the beginning of the previous verse, it says the Bodhicitta of Aspiration for verse 10, Bodhicitta of Intention on page 98. So verse 10 is the Bodhicitta of Intention, as John was just pointing out. And now we're in the Bodhicitta of Application, which I call Action Bodhicitta. Sometimes it's called Engaged Bodhicitta. So he says of this, before we even get to verse 11, Bodhicitta has two aspects, relative and absolute. And never forget this. This is where we get into the most trouble again and again, as we forget relative and absolute, both equally real, both equally important. So absolute Bodhicitta is the realization of emptiness, attained by bodhisattvas on one of the supreme levels or bhumis. So absolute bodhicitta is the realization of emptiness. That's the definition. Until that realization dawns, the emphasis in our practice and study should be placed on relative bodhicitta, which in essence is the altruistic mind, the profound wish to benefit others and be free of all selfish aims. Others first. If relative bodhicitta is practiced correctly, absolute bodhicitta will be naturally present, mixed with it, and will eventually be fully realized. So he's saying here that we need to realize both aspects, the two wings of awakening, relative and absolute bodhicitta, but we can't start with absolute bodhicitta. We won't get there. We need to start with relative bodhicitta, which is generating love and compassion. And I want to pull in, and you probably don't have this book handy, but I'm going to pull in The Great Path of Awakening here, because again, they're both mind training books, even though 37 Practices also serves as a lamrim or step-by-step path guide. This is where we're overlapping the most clearly with the mind training tradition. And so on page 6, we're in the introductory material for Great Path of Awakening, which is a presentation of the 7 points of mind training. It's in the chapter called The Need for Mind Training. And this is one of John Gongkongpo's chapters at the beginning of the book. He says the exact same thing. So I just wanted to share that. He says, true ultimate bodhicitta will not arise in the course of experience of beginners, but relative bodhicitta will definitely arise if they train in it. With the development of relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta will be realized naturally. So both books say we have to start with generating love and compassion. That's our work. That's our field of endeavor. And through that, we will naturally start to develop wisdom or ultimate bodhicitta. And he goes on to say, so for these and many similar reasons, we must meditate energetically on relative bodhicitta at the beginning if we are to achieve any meaningful results with respect to bodhicitta, to overall bodhicitta, which requires both. For someone who wishes instruction on this subject, the basic method for training is, as Shantideva says, and here he has a verse from Shantideva, and we're going to see Shantideva coming up again and again in relation to this verse, because he's the other, these are the three main mind training texts in our tradition, is Great Path of Awakening, aka Seven Points of Mind Training, 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva, and Shantideva's Way of Life of a Bodhisattva. So the verse is, he who desires shelter quickly for himself and all others, so that's shelter equals refuge, he who desires shelter quickly for himself and for all others should use this sacred mystery, the exchanging of oneself for others. And then back to Zhongong Kongchul, he says, consequently, only the method of meditation of exchanging oneself for others is explained in what follows. All other methods of mind training are simply elaborations of this theme. So that's it. This is mind training, is exchanging self for others. That is the practice of it. So again, feel free to unmute yourself or get my attention if you have a question or comment at any time. And I'll go on with Dingo Chensei. So now we begin. So within the bodhicitta application, we now begin the section on relative bodhicitta, which is the first one we need to work on. And through working on it, we will naturally develop the other bodhicitta. So he says, relative bodhicitta itself has two stages, the aspiration to benefit others and the putting of that aspiration into action. The difference between the two, and this is a classic analogy, we've all heard Lama Norla and many other teachers say this, is like the difference between wishing to go somewhere and actually setting out on the journey. So we see that Tonglen is actually setting out on the journey as opposed to just wishing. So the practice of relative bodhicitta consists of two things. A, the meditation practice of exchanging oneself and others, and B, the post-meditation practice of using unfavorable circumstances on the path. So again, we have an exact parallel here with the way it's taught in the Great Path of Awakening, or the Seven Points of Mind Training. So the first three points of mind training, there's seven in all, and these are sections, like these are different ways to train in bodhicitta. The first one is the same as the 37 practices. It's the preliminaries. And in that case, it's the four thoughts, basically. So in the Great Path of Awakening, the second point of mind training is the practice of taking and sending. That's it. Like both sitting on the cushion practice, which is described in detail, and also there's a post-meditation instruction, which is also going to be in this commentary that's coming up. I don't know if we'll get to it today. That's for when you're in daily life and not sitting on the cushion. That's always called post-meditation, or between sessions is probably a better translation, really. Post-meditation practice for how to do it. And it's what John was talking about. Like when you're having suffering, you think of everybody who has that same kind of suffering and you wish for them to be free of it because you'll just take on everybody's. That's the post-meditation for taking and sending. And then the third point of mind training is exactly what he said here as point B. He says, Dingo Chensei says, the post-meditation practice of using unfavorable circumstances on the path. And that's the structure of Great Path of Awakening, is the third point of mind training is how to bring adversity onto the path. And it's got specific methods in ultimate and relative bodhicitta. You probably remember some of the slogans, be grateful to everyone, drive all blame into one, those are the relative bodhicitta ways that we bring adversity onto the path. So that's the structure, and I love the structural stuff. I don't know if everybody loves the structural stuff as much as I do, but I'll probably always dwell on it a bit, because to me it just helps clarify how everything fits together, and then I feel like I can travel the path more easily if I know what the signposts are. Not that may not be everybody's approach, and if that's not helpful to you, then my apologies, but that's just the way my mind works. So now we get to the verse, which we read, and he has a different translation, so we'll just go on. But the practice is called exchanging my happiness, to exchange my happiness for others' suffering. That's the way a bodhisattva trains. So he says, at present, let me check the time. Oh, you know, I also have to check my battery because it was getting low. Still good. We might make it. All right. No, don't leave meeting. Okay. All right, so continue for a few more minutes with Dingo Chensei. At present, when you feel happy about yourself, you are probably quite satisfied. Other people may not be feeling happy, but you do not really consider that to be your problem. And I find myself thinking like that a lot. And then when you yourself feel unhappy, you are too preoccupied with being rid of whatever it is that is upsetting you to care or even remember that others might be feeling unhappy too. All of this is completely deluded. Like, this is the confusion, to think that we, first of all, to think that our happiness is real happiness. And then second, to think that that it's unrelated, like that our happiness alone is happiness. Like, if other people are suffering, we could still enjoy like our life, and it doesn't affect us that other people are starving or whatever. Completely deluded. He pulls no punches. He says, there is a way to train yourself to see things from a wider perspective. It is a practice called exchanging oneself and others, and consists of trying to put others in your place and put yourself in theirs. So where have we heard that in our culture? Like, a couple of places, like, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is like, that's the basis of Christianity. And then, you know, don't judge another person until you've walked a mile in their moccasins. So even in our culture, like, we recognize that basic truth, that in order to understand another person's situation, we have to put ourselves in their place. And so much of what putting ourselves first is because we don't do that. It would come naturally. And it does come naturally. I'm sure we all do this too, is that when someone is suffering or someone is hurting us, sometimes we put ourselves in their perspective. Like, we choose to try to see from their perspective. And that alone can really help a lot. Like, you put yourself in their place, and then you can feel what they're feeling. You can see how it looks through their eyes. You can experience how they're suffering in the situation. And that can really help us to bring up our bodhisattva motivation. So I would just write this big on your wall. Like, just take a paintbrush, big on the wall, others first. Like, that's, just put yourself in their shoes. So he says, the idea is, on the one hand, to imagine that you are giving away to all beings whatever good things may happen to you, however small they may be, even a spoonful of good food. So even when we're enjoying a spoonful of, you know, dolcezza, you know, gelato, we could send that happiness to everybody, including people who are starving in Syria and Bangladesh and so forth. And on the other hand, to remember the unbearable suffering that others are going through and make up your mind to take all those sufferings upon yourself with the same readiness a mother feels when she takes upon herself the suffering of her child. And we see that Angela's talking about that, doing that exact thing. Like, that's her reflex as a mother. If she was teaching some, you know, unknown person to drive, maybe it wouldn't be quite as vivid. And my battery's gonna run out. I have to take a little break and go get my power cord. I'll be right back. So you can talk among yourselves or take a meditation break. Okay, now we're good for the 10 minutes we have left. All right. That's the book. Okay, so skipping a little bit to the bottom of the page, he says, by sincerely training in the meditation practice of exchanging suffering with happiness, you will eventually become capable of actually taking on others' illness and curing them, and of giving them your happiness in reality. So we won't be able to do this yet, and this is a reservation that a lot of people have when they first hear about taking and sending, and I think we've all probably worked through that because we've had these teachings before. But right now we're not able to really take on other people's suffering through the practice of taking and sending. So we can take it on freely. Breathe in that sickness, breathe in that cancer, breathe in that pollution. You're just training your mind right now. But eventually, it'll become a superpower, a city. We could actually really do it. And there are stories of those who have in the literature. All right, so now the next part of the commentary is the meditation we already did. So we're skipping to page 110. And he has some interesting sort of supplementary methods of taking and sending on page 110. We're not going to go over those, but you could read them. I haven't been taught those. In our tradition, he's a Nyingma teacher, but they're certainly fine to do them if you want. But at the bottom of that page, something we recognize. He says, sometimes visualize that you are calling all the spirits who harm beings in various ways. You will give them your flesh to eat, your blood to drink, your bones to gnaw at, and your skin to wear. With compassion, consider that bodhicitta takes birth in their minds as they happily revel in all of these offerings. And I hope my plumber's not overhearing me right now. Buddhism? Really? How interesting. These Buddhists do interesting things. But then Christians eat the flesh of Christ and drink the blood, right? So, like, we all have it. So anybody recognize that practice? Yes, Marilyn does. Yes, I see you said chu, the chu practice. And he also, is it here? Yeah, he doesn't say it here, but I have it from somewhere. Maybe it was in the Geshe Jhampa Tekcho book. Not only chu is covered here, but also chutor. If you do chutor, I don't know if anybody here does, it's the morning water offering practice that you have to do every day. So, you know, you only take it on if you're really going to do it every day. And also sore. Like that's the evening fire puja at the monastery, same thing. This is ultimate, yes, Marilyn.
You're 60 on page 244.
Oh, that's right, it's the note, right. Yes, thank you. I knew it came from somewhere. anyway, so we have these practices in our tradition where we actually do the ultimate bodhisattva act of giving up our own flesh, our own body, for the benefit of others, and not only other people that we love, but demons, like people who want to harm us. It's a really fabulous practice. And for those of us who have the Chö empowerment, I'd be glad to do a session sometime outside the class for how to apply that, because I find I just do the short practice most days myself, the really short one-page practice, and it's just such a big part of my day to remind myself of that. It's like you just open yourself up and like, whatever it is, here I am. You just come and get me. All resistance dropped. I'm just offering myself. And of course, you know that you're not going to really feel that happen. So it's perfectly safe. But mentally, you know, it's very helpful to just, it drops all the tension. It drops all of the feeling of us versus them. Because I just include everything that's happening to me. You know, yes, here, you know, have it, have what you want. You know, eat my flesh if that's what you want. And it just helps take the tension out of everything. So I think, I guess we're going to stop here with the text. We're going to get into some really interesting things after this. And if you haven't read the chapter yet, please read it for next week. For next week, take a look at the website if you haven't yet, and do that meditation. It's the same meditation. It's just do some Tonglen every day. It's another exhortation to remember to do some meditation every day and kind of upping the ante, like 5 minutes is still fulfills the requirement. If you're not able to do 5 minutes of meditation yet, that's a frontier that needs to be worked on, because we're not going to make much progress if we can't sit for 5 minutes. But start thinking about 10 to 15 minutes if you're at 5 minutes now. And if you're already doing more, and I know some people are, like, that's great. You know, this is just for people who, which is so many people, like, it's just so hard to just bring ourselves to sit on the cushion without doing something. So every day try to sit and do whatever practice you do, but include some taking and sending. And you can use the Two Wings of Meditation sheet. If anybody can't find it, I'd be glad to resend it. But it includes everything. Preliminaries and Shine and Ultimate Bodhicitta and Relative Bodhicitta. Try to do that every day, because that's, we're going to spend the next 2 weeks like honing that tool, because we're going to need it for boot camp, which comes up in 2 weeks. So next week we're going to continue with this verse, because there's still a fair amount of wealth in Indigo Chense's commentary, and I'd like to look at Ken's briefly too for the Western perspective. So I'm going to unmute everybody for a minute before we do our anybody have anything they'd like to say? Then I guess we can do our prayers. John, yeah.
Real quick. John, yeah. Can you read? Can you restate or remind us the two words that karma something?
Karma something.
Yeah, I'm gonna mute everybody. There's a lot of yes, and I'll unmute John. It's others first.
He divided into two. He said it was two words to shorten that encompasses mind training.
Others first.
Thank you.
That's it. And try to recognize. So besides really carving out some time for the cushion to do taking and sending, and reread this verse, like learn the verse. We're going to get some reinforcement for that approach later in the chapter. Besides that, look, like really examine all of your interactions as much as you can, and notice the me first, and try to go to others first, and see what happens. See if there's a way to work that out in the midst of turmoil or non-turmoil, just whatever's happening, whatever mundane things are happening. Like, how does mind training apply to that situation? And it'll be happening all the time. So that's it today. So the meditation is to do it on the cushion, and the post-meditation is to notice it, like outside, and how we can apply exchanging my happiness for others' suffering. How can we apply that in every situation that arises? And we'll make mistakes, and we'll be confused sometimes, and we'll feel like we can't give away the store sometimes. And we just do our best in every situation, because we only learn by getting confused and sometimes making mistakes or catching it later or, you know, whatever. But just really make this a priority to notice this week. And I'll try to get the rest of the class notes up on the website. All right, I'm going to try to find my folder with the prayers now. Okay, we'll do our dedication of merit. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, and from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate all virtue fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. So bring our minds to rest for a moment. First, in just letting ourselves rest in the feeling of being grounded and present in our physical body, instead of caught up in all of our thoughts. Following our breath a little bit. And on the out breath, letting our breath expand to fill all of limitless empty space, and letting our mind expand with it to fill all of limitless empty space and resting in that for a moment. And then imagining that space filled completely with sentient beings, all of whom are suffering, and that they've all been our mothers or been kind to us in previous lifetimes, and generating the wish, the really heartfelt, warm wish for them to be happy and to attain liberation. And so once you've generated that, you can rest non-conceptually. You go back to just resting non-conceptually, but you have this, your heart is engaged now. It's like awareness that's suffused with love and compassion. And that brings us to 2:30. So I'll unmute everybody for a second, and then I'll unmute exercise in the hour again. Okay, well, I'll see you next week, and it won't be chaotic next week. Hopefully, all goes well.
Bye, Lana.
My office. Okay, everybody, have a good week.
You too.